Good morning, Grant Edwards for Liberty NZ and Counterspin Media. Well, the anticipation and excitement is high following RCR's initial reveal 2 weeks ago. Now, in case you're wondering who RCR is, that's Reality Check Radio. And the station will feature Paul Brennan, Rodney Hyde, Chantal Baker and Peter Williams to begin with more content and shows in the pipeline. I'm looking forward to hearing the first hour and a half. I heard it this morning and I want to hear it again because there were some incredible topics raised and they had a fabulous chat. So let's join Chantal Baker, Rodney Hyde, Paul Brennan and Peter Williams right now. I hope you enjoy it.
Well, here we are, the first broadcast of RCR, Reality Check Radio, the latest development in New Zealand media. And I would say, and of course I would say that, a necessary and essential one. And it's me, Paul Brennan, and we're doing this because I'm doing the first show. Just turned out that way. But I have with me in a beautiful podcast studio somewhere in Christchurch. We're sitting in Chantal Baker's podcast studio to do this broadcast. Chantal, thank you so much for, first of all, coming on board, but also providing this great environment to have our first broadcast from and our get-together for the first time on air. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul. And it's awesome to meet all of you guys in person. Today's the first day I actually see your beautiful faces.
Oh, thank you. So with me is...
Oh, Rodney Hyde. Yes, Chantal, those broadcasts you did from the protest were fantastic because you just made the people that were there come alive and speak to us, to all of New Zealand. And there was no mainstream media coverage, and it was you. And it was so wonderful because there was a connection that you had with the people that came through to me. So thank you for that. You were amazing. Myself, I'm loving this. I'm loving being involved with RCR. It just feels a lot of energy. There's a lot of excited people. It's good to be associated with something that's clearly successful with successful people. And I'm just so pumped about listening. You know, because I talk about intelligent conversation, but the key to intelligent conversation is listening. And it's not talking, it's listening. And I think we've largely lost that art of listening to the other side, to other people, to other views, to other ideas.
And we have to check ourselves for that too, don't we?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely, because you've always got to stop and think, am I right? Because I've been wrong about so many things. And no one has a monopoly on truth.
Rodney made the point about your, what do you call them, broadcast streams from, we know the occasion. And I just wonder how that felt at the time, whether you realised the gravity of what you were doing at the time. It's probably a bit of a blur now, maybe. I don't know. But because I was there, I was watching. It was the most compelling stuff, you know, it was just incredible.
You couldn't get into your day because you had to see what was going to happen next.
Yeah.
It was thrilling, that's for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, it was, I don't know how to describe it. I think because every single day, and this was strategic on the police's part, every single day, and I know that because we've got a guy who's ex-special forces on our team and I've got a lot of military friends, so they were constantly ringing me and messaging me and telling me kind of what was happening and what plans were and what the actions would be of the police, that type of thing. But every day they would come in at a different time with a different amount of force, doing different things and different kind of antagonistic things. And it was all very purposeful and designed to make people, to make the protesters as neurotic as possible. And so the longer that it went on, the more you kind of saw that play out. And every single day you were nervous and on edge. And, you know, we had to stay in all these different places between like the camper van, which was parked legally in the Law Society building, to an Airbnb, and then we had a room that someone had given us that was, we had three of us packed in this tiny little room, and we had to run like, you know, a mile or a couple of miles with all the camera equipment at like 3 a.m. to try and get to where the police were. And everything would happen so suddenly that, I don't know, you're just, you're keeping people on the journey with you, but you're still experiencing it firsthand yourself. And so as much as you're trying to talk people through the process, you're still a human being experiencing raw dramatic emotion. And I think that that raw dramatic emotion is what people felt through the screen and probably what kept people watching and coming back. It's because they were kind of experiencing it firsthand as well.
It sort of felt like I remember looking at your viewing stats, you know, in real time, and feeling curious about what the mainstream media were doing on that. And I went to, I won't say which one, but I went to one of the sites and had them both on at the same time. You had 20,000 people watching, and the other mainstream had 223.
Wow.
Well, I mean, we got an OIA back the other day. And for people who don't know, it's an Official Information Act request. So we do a number of them here where we're trying to dig information out of the government. And we got one back, and it was a report that I think the Disinformation Project had given the government a month or a couple of months after the protest, I think, if I'm remembering this appropriately. And it said that the live streams that we had in the reach of our content for a number of months was three times what the official COVID-19 website was getting. So I'm not surprised that they didn't want us to stay up.
Tell me, because this is all strange to me, what's a disinformation project? I've heard of it, and it seems a peculiar thing. What is a disinformation project?
It's a group of individuals that were pulled together under the Auckland University bracket. So a lady called Kate, a guy called Sanjana, a couple of people. Now, the ideology is Marxist. So Marxist socialist. Kate identifies as a fourth wave feminist. So radical, very radical ideas. And these people have been put in charge of basically judging what speech should and shouldn't be allowed on the internet. So they decided that I was not allowed a voice on the internet, is what they decided, which is ironic because Sanjana, who's part of the Disinformation Project, actually started as a citizen journalist using social media in Sri Lanka to speak out against what he disapproved of with his government. So you've got a group of people that are relatively radical. That's my perception of Marxism anyway. I do find it more of a radical ideology. So they have certain ideas that they want to implement here in New Zealand, and they're given a very large platform across TV, national media, to have that voice.
So you see, this is disinformation. This is disinformation. How do they determine what
you would
is
that
disinformation?
Well,
Karl Marx would never have said that.
I think so, because I went to see one of them speak, and I sat front row at the event because I didn't want to hide. You know, I wasn't trying to get away with anything. I sat front row at the event, and I waited for the whole speech, and at the end they did a Q&A, and I said, look, my name's Chantal Baker. You've said that what I say is disinformation, but you've also said that I'm pro the Kremlin, which is absolutely false. So
pro the what?
Pro the Kremlin. Yeah, I know. Well, let's just slide past that one because I don't even know how to address everything in
that. How did they come to that?
Oh, because I talked about a very real situation where the Ukrainian embassy had changed a number of PDFs on their website that were pertaining to how some of their biolabs were funded.
Right.
So they had updated them, and I spoke about that, which is a real situation that did happen, and apparently that made me pro the Kremlin. So moving on. So I asked, just because there's too much to unpack in that one. So I asked Kate, face to face, I said, how do you classify disinformation? Because what you've said about me would be classified in my eyes as disinformation. And she would not answer. She wouldn't answer the question. She repeatedly blew it off, and then other people asked some questions, including like, how can I be an activist against people like Chantal? So she was happy to answer that, but she couldn't answer what disinformation
is. So disinformation's a bad thing.
Oh, yes.
This project, these Marxist feminists, whatever, they'll decide what is disinformation.
Mm-hmm.
And then what is the relationship back to government? And what happens if I do disinformation inadvertently?
Well, that's a very good question. I mean, they've
very naughty boy.
Put in the naughty
so
corner.
We got OIAs back that showed that during that time period she was funded by the government, even though I asked her that question and she said no, she's mainly funded by her husband. She was funded directly from the Prime Minister's office, so she was funded directly from Jacinda to go on live television and say, you know, the protesters are full of disinformation, even though she never said one thing that I said that was disinformation. So it's quite like this network of people.
Oh, wow. So she's funded by the government and she's sitting there saying this is disinformation. Information because they're not agreeing with the government.
Yeah.
Nothing to see there.
Nothing.
When was the last time, well, I know you've been on radio, Peter, recently, but the last gig you had, take us back to that.
That was late August, early September of 2021.
Right.
So I was working for the Media Works organisation, on a radio station called Magic Talk, and I had the 9 to 12 morning talkback slot. And I'd been doing that since I finished in television at the end of 2018, so I'd been there, what, 2¾ years. It was, to be perfectly honest, Paul, as somebody who's worked a long time in radio yourself, you will know that talk radio is a very, very tough gig. Reading the news on TV is, frankly, a piece of cake. It's the easiest job I ever had in broadcasting, and I'm prepared to say that to anybody because it is and it was. That, you know, you have a team of producers to give you everything when you do the news on TV. When you're on radio, you've got a three-hour blank canvas every morning, and you have to fill it. And you have to hope that people ring you up to have conversations. Otherwise, you've just got to talk and talk and talk. And sometimes people did not ring you up. So you had to talk and talk and talk. So it was tough going. But I picked up something early on, and I don't know what set off the spark in my brain about the concept of vaccination mandates. That, to me, just went against the grain of what I thought as an individual, because I'm a believer in freedom of association, freedom of speech, of democracy, of having... I mean, I believe that you should... You know best how to spend the money you make. The government, this government, has decided that it knows better. I'm also a great believer in the socialising of an education system and the socialising of a health system. I don't have a problem with either of those concepts, as long as those education and health systems are efficient and run well. And in this country at the moment, they're not. Anyway, getting back to where I was with MediaWorks, with Magic Talk, I... espouse some arguments, some theories about the efficacy of the vaccine, about whether or not it worked, about whether or not it had had long enough to be tested. And the answer, of course, is that it hadn't been. It was, and we're finding this out now from some eminently qualified scientists and epidemiologists, that it wasn't tested properly, and that Pfizer themselves have subsequently said that they never tested to see whether it stopped transmission. So my concerns about the vaccine mandates were well-founded. But apparently that was not allowed to be said by the radio station. And as a consequence, I was told to stop espousing that particular line.
How did they do that?
I mean, well, they said to me, your program's become known as... anti-vax central. I said, really?
Like a railway station.
Wow. Yeah. So I said, well, isn't it good that there is at least one space in the airwaves where these particular things can be talked about? Other, you know, after all, we are a free liberal society, are we not? A democratic society where freedom of speech is allowed. And the line that this is the line that tipped me over the edge. They said, well, there will be financial implications for the company and for the station if you don't change your thinking. Wow. And I thought, well, there's only one thing to go here, only one thing to do here. So I quit the next day. I had a ponder on that particular comment, and I resigned the next day. I called up the boss on a Thursday, and he was a bit shocked. He said, we'll get back to you on the Saturday. And I said, this was very early September of 2021. And I said, look, I'm prepared to, I'll give you some notice. I'm prepared to work out the month. I'm even prepared to work out the end of the year, but I'm not, you know, going to be here long term. I should tell you that now. And we had a conversation again on Saturday, and it was a case of, you can go now. I said, fine, thank you. Mm. Big weight off my shoulders, just like that. Yeah. So, you know, I finished on the Friday, fully expecting to be back on air on the Monday. But it wasn't to be, and that's okay. I just walked away. I had another project in my life. We were building a house in Wanaka at the time, so I just flew to Wanaka the next week, and I've been in the South Island ever since.
Well, welcome.
Yeah.
Tell me, Peter, the financial implications.
Mm.
Did you take that to mean advertising?
Oh, totally.
Or government money?
Well, Was MediaWorks getting a cut of the PIJF, the Public Interest Journalism Fund? I suppose it was.
And they'd be getting government advertising by the
government. Government advertising. COVID advertising. That was the key to it. And, of course, in early 2022, Simeon Brown, who I think is a great little ferret and workhorse for the opposition, came up with this extraordinary figure that the government in the financial year had spent $125 million in advertising on the New Zealand media, and the next biggest advertiser that I could find out, going back in previous years, the biggest advertiser in New Zealand is traditionally an outfit like Harvey Norman or Toyota, and they spend around about $70 to $75 million a year. So here was in that year of 2021-22, the New Zealand government spending $125 million in advertising, the vast bulk of which would have been, you know, COVID-19 advertising, get the vaccine, do the test, blah, blah, blah.
That's the interesting thing that you realise when you get involved in the modern media, is that the censorship isn't the censorship that you think it is. It's extraordinarily subtle.
Yes, but there once upon a time, there was a thing called, well, they have it in the finance industry too, don't they, the Chinese walls.
Yeah.
The Chinese wall in finance is that those guys selling the shares are not punting the shares that the investment bank is trying is trying to float. So there's a Chinese wall between the brokers and the bankers. In the media, there is supposed to be a Chinese wall between those in the newsroom and those in the advertising department, or those in the production editorial department and those in advertising. You know, never the twain shall meet. They come together for an on-air product whereby there is program and there is advertising. In commercial radio, as Paul well knows, yes, there is quite often a blurring of the lines, but never in my experience before had there ever been a blurring of the lines to the stage where the advertiser, and even worse is the advertiser was the government here, the advertiser was actually dictating terms about what was being said and discussed on the air. And that to me was just a point of no return. I was fortunate in that I was at the time 67 years old. I was past retirement age. I'd worked in the industry for best part of 50 years, 49 years. So, and I was financially secure, so I didn't need to work.
But just
I got out because it was a point of principle. I was happy to keep on working, but didn't need to. Therefore, I was not going to put up with that crap.
Imagine,
so I walked.
Imagine if you were 20 year old.
Oh, precisely, precisely.
And I noticed that with my little kids, even in primary school, that they're already learning not to express what they think. And not to question certain things, and basically to buy in to what the government says. And it's this terrible thing of like everyone pretending in a series of lies, because I don't even think the teachers believe it.
Well, you see, I don't have any direct involvement with the education system because my children are adults, and because I don't see what my grandchildren in New Zealand are educated, or how they're educated on a day-to-day basis.
Well, that's part of it too.
Yeah, I know, but what
you kept you out of it.
What I'm beginning to feel and to understand from listening, talking, reading, is that we don't have an education system as such anymore. We have an indoctrination system, and I just think that is just terrible. I mean, Rodney, you tell me that you've got kids at primary school age, and they don't teach them to read and write and count anymore. I mean, what the hell is going on?
You don't get taught the times table, but you get a lot about climate change, a lot about...
But how can they possibly understand 1.5 degrees of global warming if they don't have numeracy skills, Rodney?
Oh, no. You see, you've got to get your morals right. You see, you're thinking that there's a real world out there. What you're saying is you've got to get your morals right, your ethics. You've got to care for the planet and be kind. That's enough. And being kind and care. You're going to be kind and care, otherwise we will bully you and subject you to – I mean, that's one of the – There's so much hypocrisy around all of this because, you know, you have to go along and wave a pride flag or do that, and if you don't, you'll be bullied. And the kids say, but isn't this about anti-bullying, you know? And then
that's a hard question.
Yeah, yeah. And if you say, oh, we're really into diversity, and you say, yeah, well, I've got this. No, you can't ask that question.
Well, it's like inclusivity, the whole Israel Folau scenario, if whatever that was, 2019. Rugby league says, oh, we're a very inclusive sport. Or was it, what game was he playing at the time? He switched around a bit. Was it rugby union, I think. Rugby union. He was with our friend Raylene Castle, wasn't he? She was the one who fired him. Raylene Castle said Rugby Australia is a very inclusive sport, except it doesn't want to include anybody who has Christian conservative beliefs. So well, how can you be inclusive when you're excluding Israel Folau? I mean, that to me is just bizarre.
Oh, you're just...
Or am I too logical?
No, you're an old white dinosaur, and the world will be a better place when your generation has died out, because what I've learned is that, you know, I can go along to the local public library, dress up as a woman, you know, and...
Is this a confession?
No, I could do. And read to little kids, right, and dance provocatively. But imagine if I went along and read them Christian teachings. Do you think I'd be allowed to do that?
Or went along wearing a Captain Cook uniform.
Oh, God, yeah. With security. The Captain Cook one is particularly upsetting to me because he was just such an amazing man. Such an amazing man, and now we're funding and teaching the kids that he was despicable, that he was evil, that he visited all this oppression and colonialism on the world.
And then they talk about colonialism as if that's the only terrible thing that's ever happened in New Zealand. And yes, there were awful things that were committed during colonisation, but there have also been horrific things committed throughout tribes throughout the world for hundreds and thousands.
Aren't some things, though, best left unsaid after a certain period, because you can go down into vortex.
Of course.
They did this, you did
that. The Romans did that.
Yeah. Who did the worst thing? No, you did the worst thing.
Isn't this an extraordinary conceit that you can look back on history and fix it or put it right?
Good luck with that.
I mean, good luck. And I mean, the reality is, no one here now was there then.
No, but the history of the world, Rodney, is about invasion and about, well, we use the word colonisation. It's about basically taking over the country. I mean, how did modern day Britain come to be? It was because the Normans invaded them.
Yes.
So do people in Britain, you know, the Anglo-Saxons, do they want to get reparations from the French because the Normans invaded them in 1066?
No, but
that's the ludicrous nonsense that you could discuss if we're going to look at modern-day New Zealand historical discussion.
And you see, this is part of this terrible thing of identity, isn't it?
Mm.
That not only are you pigeonholed because of something you have no control over, you know, you happen to be white, European extraction male, and then you're pigeonholed, but more particularly, you would say that because you're white male. You don't have any agency. You don't have any free will. You don't have any ability to think or discuss.
And then you shut up.
Yeah. And then you have this sort of hierarchy of identity. And we know right at the bottom is Peter. Right? I'm slightly above Peter, you know, because I've got some disabilities.
Have you?
Yeah. I'm bald.
All right. Yeah.
You said that I could never be a successful politician for as long as I bought. So, no, but you go up, don't you? And then you get, you know,
it's the other way around, isn't it? As you go as far down as you can to the absolute singular victim.
Yes.
What is that? Who is that?
What is that?
I mean, where does it stop?
It doesn't.
But the sad thing is they're creating this victimhood status that people that are real victims often don't want to have. People that I know that are disabled don't want to be called disabled. They don't want to be treated like that. They want to be treated like normal human beings that are functional and capable because they are. They actually want to be treated equally. And I think we've taken equal and we've turned it into equality, and now we're trying to balance out any perceived nuances that we have in a victimhood status. Absolutely. But my favourite line about everything is, well, not about everything, but just about that particular topic we were talking about before, is every single genetic line that currently exists in New Zealand immigrated here.
Yeah. Of course. But how about
historical fact?
Yeah,
historical fact.
We all came out of Africa. Isn't it wonderful though that you can live in an age where you can be a prince, right, and a Hollywood actress, and at the same time be victims?
I mean, I'm impressed.
That is
genius.
Genius, right?
How do you
poor
how
me?
Do you put that together?
Yeah. They just don't want to be seen.
There, you're sitting there working away, trying to make a dollar, put food on the table, pay the rent, pay the gas bill, and there's poor Harry. Oh, I've had a terrible.
But the thing is, if people didn't buy into it, it wouldn't be there. Mm. Just flicking back to what you were saying, Peter, and the advertising. Mm. I interviewed a woman recently. I forget her name. Wish I could remember her name. She did a very good piece. All that COVID money. That budget for health related to COVID, normally spent by the health ministry, was all controlled by the Department of the Prime Minister.
Mm. Yep,
all
it
that
was.
Money.
It was, yeah.
So
yeah.
that, and there was only one person ultimately responsible for that department calling the shots. So that's why that phone call would have come from a long way up.
Well, That may be a conspiracy theory. You might be down a rabbit hole, Paul. I don't know.
I've never been in a rabbit hole.
I've never been in a rabbit hole, I didn't know.
Yeah. Around your part of the country, yeah, I know that there are many of them.
Yeah, that's right. I just didn't think of it like that. And I didn't really want to know. I don't really want to know now.
But it's
fact. If that was the case, then that's even more despicable, and I feel even better.
Well, that's how it got into the newsroom. That's the point I'm making. That's why that Chinese wall was busted through.
Yeah.
And the fascinating thing is, once you're through the pandemic, that hasn't ended.
No. Mm. All the settings are there.
All the settings are there. All the control is there. All the expectation is there. Mm. And so all around New Zealand newsrooms are having a watchful eye. And, I mean, how extraordinary is it that you'd be on a radio worried what the Prime Minister's office might think.
Well, I wasn't thinking that, but what...
My point is, you know the station was, and historically, you know, if you're upsetting the Prime Minister's office, you're doing your job.
Yeah, that's right. Well, what I did notice, and I did that job for 2¾ years, despite numerous requests, even during the 2020 election campaign, the Prime Minister not once would appear on that radio show.
Didn't someone else spit the dummy as well? Said they wouldn't come back on. Was that with you?
No, that was the deputy, Grant Robertson, yeah.
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 Because I asked him a question about what do you know about the Great Reset? And I don't necessarily know what the Great Reset really means, except I know that there is a book and various videos produced by the World Economic Forum called The Great Reset. What's the saying? You will have nothing, but you will be happy, or something like that. Yeah. Anyway, I asked, and Grant Robertson was about to address the Society of Accountants, I think, in a few days after we did this particular interview, and I think the topic for the speech was something like, you know, the reset or the Great Reset. The word reset was certainly used in the theme, but he accused me of conspiracy theories, and he's, you know, that was on air. And then later that day, we just got an email from his office saying Grant doesn't want to come on the radio show to waste time shooting down conspiracy theories. End of story. That was that.
He was the guy who said build back better, though, early on, didn't he? Because I've heard a few of them say that.
He may well have, yeah.
And
yeah.
I think our current Prime Minister only mentioned that line the other day. So just saying.
Well, Jacinda was sent a copy of the Great Reset book signed by him. We found it in an OIA.
Signed by Schwab.
Yeah, signed by Klaus Schwab. So she received the book. It was signed by him. She thanked him for sending her the book. So this isn't, I mean, this is just common.
Yeah, but you see, that
this is
question,
not a rabbit hole.
It's in an OIA. It's like, oh, it's so painful.
Would be disinformation, right?
Oh, yeah, disinformation.
But what about poor Maureen Pugh, MP? Mm. So as poor Maureen Pugh, MP, says, and she said about the recent cyclone, she said, well, I'd just like to see the evidence from the minister that this was caused by climate change.
Mm. Yeah.
Well, that's a very reasonable question.
Well, fancy just being able to claim that just off the top of your head that there's some connection here. Now, who was it who claimed that? Whoever it was,
everyone.
Honestly, everybody.
Where did
yeah.
you get that from? And now we know about Niwa.
Yeah.
Data not there. Anyway, sorry, Karen.
But I mean. That's a fairly innocuous question, right? To which you'd say, well, I don't know the answer to that. I'll go and ask, you know, officials, or here it is, have a look at it. She got shot down for it. Here's the amazing thing to me. She got shot down for that, not from the government, but from her own party leader. Now, that question that she asked, she would have been speaking for a great bulk of New Zealanders with that question. And she
You've been a politician. Explain it.
Explain what?
Well, why would she fold and get on her knees and apologise? And lose dignity.
Because there's nothing more bullying than a party leader when you're sitting on the list. So they would have said, get into line or you're gone. And political parties, they are machines for knocking into shape wayward MPs. They're extremely good at it. And so, you know, wouldn't have been Mr. Luxon that would give her the talking to. It'd be another MP or maybe
even have come from? Who would have said, hey, wait on, did you hear what she said? Do something about it. I mean, where does that come from?
No, that come from him. So he's saying, I'm saying this, we're going to agree with the government on this. And, of course, as soon as you've got the opposition agreeing with the government, you can't even ask questions about this. Mm. And then you disenfranchise every New Zealander who has a question about it. And, I mean, that question of the Great Reset, that was a question that lots of New Zealanders had. It mightn't even be Peter's view. But he, as a talkback host, as a person with a microphone and an audience, he could be asking that question on behalf of his audience. But a politician now doesn't believe, if they don't want to answer a question, they'll just dismiss you and actually dismiss that big chunk of your audience.
And if they don't want to appear on a show anymore, as Ardern did not after a while with Hosking, because she obviously found the questions too hard, she just did in front. I mean, it was the most extraordinary act of political cowardice that I've ever known in this country. Why would the Prime Minister not appear on a breakfast radio show because the questions were too difficult? I mean, frankly, it really came as no surprise that she pulled the pin and walked away when she did, if she was fired by her own colleagues.
A lot of people, because there were comments about that, were, good on you, go girl.
Yeah.
You know, it was like... Yeah. You know, they
shouldn't have to put up with this crap because it was a smart move.
He was asking questions. But here's the thing about the supine nature of journalists now. Ordinarily, you'd expect other journalists to write critical commentary and articles about a prime minister refusing to front up.
Mm. But only one journalist did, and that was Barry Soper, who was the political editor for the station concerned. Yeah. So he would be duty-bound, well, apart from the fact that he thought that personally anyway, but he would like to toe the company line.
Save space.
And say that she was a coward, and she was. And frankly, I can't see how anybody can reach any other conclusion.
No. But, I mean, if you're Prime Minister or you're a politician, you're answerable to the people of New Zealand.
Yeah.
Someone with a microphone has got an audience. You would expect them to take questions. And if a question is out of line...
Don't you sign up for that?
Yes. And if the question is out of line, you play the game with the audience. And you can say, listen, Mr. Hosking, I'm not going there. Mm. And the audience can judge, right? And you've seen many, many politicians get into an argument with a journalist and you're sitting at home with your dinner on your lap.
Great entertainment.
And you're making a judgment too. Yeah. But to not turn up, unspeakable.
Chantelle, I want to ask you about journalism because you, I think, had a really unique kind of insight into what you were doing. I don't know if you call yourself a journalist. I think you're probably an honorary one from what you've done. You had mainstream media there all the time you were there. And you were there doing your thing. Tell us your thoughts on journalism.
I mean, I don't call myself a journalist because I don't. I don't call myself that. I don't think that what my work necessarily is journalism as such. I think I do more reporting and then social and political commentary. That's more where I see myself. Other people have called me a citizen journalist and things like that, but that's kind of up to every person, I think, to kind of discern how they view the content and view what we put out. But we've all been incredibly disappointed, I would say, by the legacy media here in New Zealand and how much money they have taken from the taxpayers and how much trust we have put in them, and then to see the outcome over the last few years. And basic questions were never asked. They openly ridiculed people. And so I think that it's really, it shook my faith years ago when I saw my dad was running for politics, Leighton Baker, and I would see the interviews that they would do with him in real life and then what they would play. And they were two completely different things. And so I started to understand what the media was capable of from seeing that. And then obviously I've seen it with firsthand for myself now as well. So it's sad seeing where journalism has got to. I mean, I've had a phone call from a journalist recently, and I don't answer anymore because I know what they want. They're wanting a tiny soundbite from me, and they've already got their story. They've got everything that they want to write about me, and they want me to just pick up their phone call so they can tick a box and say, yes, we spoke to her. And they're going through every single person that I may have interacted with on Facebook and ringing them and asking them for dirt, even if they've told them repeatedly they've only met me once. So, I mean, if that's the state of journalism in our country, but they can't look at how Pfizer's funded, or they can't look at the process of getting this approval through the FDA, then what is the point? Why are we paying hundreds of millions of dollars to these organisations? I'm still struggling to understand that, but I think it comes down to they are happy to put forward propaganda, and they're happy to put it forward en masse as long as the money is coming in to sustain the amount of staff that they've got.
You just reminded me the coverage of the story of the WhatsApp messages leak.
Oh, Matt Hancock?
Yeah, the woman who broke that story, and to The Telegraph, as it turned out. I've been watching a few interviews with her, particularly with the woman who got into trouble with Jordan Peterson, Kathy Newman, and a few others. One thing I've noticed, and you saying that has kind of reminded me of this, is they didn't seem to be interested in the actual story, which is an incredible story.
Incredible.
I mean, it's mind-blowing story and scary. What seemed to occupy them more was the way she released it and why she chose The Telegraph and why didn't she talk to that journalist or this journalist. And it was all about that and completely avoided the story. And I'm thinking, is there something wrong with you, or is that purposeful? Is that like a kind of playbook strategy?
What would you make of that? It's completely purposeful. They're attacking her. They're not actually attacking the issue. The issue is that it shows clear corruption within the system of the United Kingdom's government at the time and how they chose to approach COVID. That's actually the issue, is the corruption and the deep levels of corruption and how they put forward their COVID policy. But what they choose to do is to attack her and to try and break down her character and disempower her as a human being, essentially, in a virtual sense, to the masses, so that they distrust her. Because what they want to make sure we do is distrust anybody that comes forward with something negative about the government, particularly if the government was the one that were if it was the government that was implementing the COVID policy. And so that's very clearly what is happening to her. And it shocks me that no New Zealand media have picked up on that story about The Telegraph. I think there was one piece in, there was one piece in one newspaper, but it came because they basically buy stories and they automatically get pulled and put onto their website.
Realize.
Yeah, I don't know if they realised.
Hey, don't go.
But every other news station is dead silent, and that tells you so much about the level of, I think it's just people are desperate for money. These news organisations are desperate for money locally here in New Zealand. You don't have enough subscribers.
Yeah, what condition are they in, do you think? Economically
without the government, dire with the government. I mean, they just hired hundreds more new journalists in the last 2 years, so they're sitting happy at the moment.
Yeah, it's interesting what you say about that. Let's look at the major media organisations in New Zealand. TVNZ, in the last financial year, made a decent profit. This past financial year, their most recent result was they were pretty marginal. Radio New Zealand, non-commercial, so it doesn't matter whether they have a profit or a loss. If they have a loss, the government just tops them up. And after the failed merger, they're going to get more money anyway. To the other organisations, NZME, well, it's a stock market listed company. It has to report a profit. It makes a reasonable turnover, a reasonable profit. I think somewhere off the top of my head in the 20 million or whatever.
In that ballpark, maybe.
On revenue of about, I'm just, again, making this stuff up. Not making this stuff up, trying to recall it, because I have read it. Mm. But I think their revenue is around about 300 million. MediaWorks made a loss. And Stuff, well, Stuff is owned by the editor, the managing editor, and they're a privately held company, so they don't report. But one imagines.
Apparently things are a bit tight there, I've heard.
But, and you have to think about how much the margins over the last few years have been propped up by COVID advertising as well.
Yeah.
And that's the big question. It's you've got government grants which are helping, but you've also got the just absolute huge amount of advertising that has been pumped into those organisations that normally would not be there.
At full retail.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm.
Well, bought for a dollar.
Stuff was bought for a dollar. Yeah,
that's right.
Plus the debts.
They're probably pleased to get rid of it for a dollar.
But I think deeper than that, the journalists truly believe the same as Labor, same as a lot of different government employees, that their view is the only one that should be tolerated. That's what they genuinely believe. Yeah. I don't think it's some nefarious reason. I don't think they're purposefully necessarily trying to mislead people. I think that they just genuinely believe that their way is the only way.
Do we have bona fide journalism telling both sides of the story anymore, or do we have activism disguised as journalism, or journalism disguised as activism? Because when I look at a lot of the copy these days, that's what I see. And I think it really comes back to the education, the training of journalists. Until the early 1990s, journalists learnt on the job. They left school and they became cadets at newspapers, and off they went and did the copy running jobs, did basically that they went and got the minor stuff, came up with facts for the senior reporters. They learned from the old grunts in the newsroom about how to do it. They learnt on the job. Then along came the need for competitive education. So, therefore, the universities and the tertiary education started pitching against each other for students. It was about bums on seats. So, let's come up with a journalism course. And up until then, there'd hardly been a journalism course in the country. People,
I think there was a Polytech course.
Well, there was a Polytech course somewhere in Wellington, which was run by Wellington Polytech, part of Massey University, 1 year. There was a postgrad thing at Canterbury University, but that was about it. Then they just exploded everywhere. You could do journalism and broadcasting courses anywhere in the country. Sometimes at quite expensive, quite expensive fees attached.
Yeah, big loans.
And out of those courses came students who were not taught about balance and about, well, they certainly weren't taught too much about how to construct stories in terms of good grammar, good writing, good spelling and all that kind of thing, from what I saw, some of the graduates that came into the newsroom at TVNZ. So, again, I come back to the education system, and it's like the education we're now having in primary schools, which is more and more indoctrination, and it was a case of those journalism schools also having indoctrination being part and parcel of the way things were done.
I think there's something around, the fees that you mentioned, because, I mean, business is business. People have got to feel that they're getting value for the money that they're putting up. And us knowing, because we've seen it before the earlier era, what was involved in moving into journalism, becoming a journalist, it wasn't that expensive. You're not going to have a huge loan over your head. You've got to sell that value of that loan. And, the day-to-day stuff is not that pretty or romantic. But if you're being told that you can save the world with this qualification, this is the best money you'll ever spend. And it's cynical because it's only business. They want the bums, like you said, the bums on seats. And, I don't know what the latest rate is for a degree in journalism as a student loan, but I'm sure it's in the tens of thousands of dollars at least. And, the salaries aren't that big in the initial part, PRs later, and we can talk about that. So it makes sense to oversell the qualification.
It's unbelievably cruel. But there's also this thing happening that you see it in journalism, but it's reflected right through, and that is a philosophical shift, whereas we grew up, with the view that there was a world out there that was objective and real. To put it in journalistic terms, there's news, there's stuff happening. And your job as a human being is to try and understand the world around you. Your job as a journalist to go there and report what's happening. And that means, you know, understanding what's happening and reporting it. And you do so in a way that is striving towards objectivity of the story.
Where the chips fall.
Where the chips fall, wherever the story takes you. But now, from day one, from kindergarten, the generations are being taught activism. So there's now no longer an objective world. There's views of the world. There's good views and bad views of the world, and I have a good view of the world. He clearly has a bad view of the world because he disagrees with me. Mm. How can it possibly be good? It's so easy for them.
And that's where narratives come.
That's right. They have a narrative. I'm telling the right narrative. You've got the wrong narrative. And so the journalists now are activists, and they're campaigning. And the funny thing is, the newspapers will tell you this. You know, the newspapers took on the job of campaigning to get everyone vaccinated. Mm. You know, not reporting it, but that was their goal.
Well, let's remember the 2019 campaign, which, again, I pushed back against, and I'll give credit to MediaWorks on this occasion because there was no pushback against me then. But every major news media company in New Zealand was on the whole climate change bandwagon.
Yes. Mm.
And this was led by, I think, the BBC and Time and CNN.
How disgusting is that?
So everybody joined up with this worldwide reportage for a whole week on climate change matters, and that this is happening and the world is going to hell in a handbasket because of the fact that we drive way too many Ford Rangers.
Yeah.
And our
Why
sheep.
Why pick on me?
Our sheep.
I just got a Ford Ranger. Much.
Leave my Volvo out of it.
I've just got a Ford Ranger, and you're attacking me.
Yeah, but I made a point that week of being deliberately contrarian. And I don't know where that particular streak in me comes from, but I thought, well, there's a few blokes that I'd heard about and read called Richard Linson, William Happer, Willie Soon. These are guys, highly qualified PhDs in physics, and knew about the climate. They were real climate scientists, in my opinion, and they were debunking the theory. Of course, they were criticised because they were taking money from the oil industry.
It's so easy, isn't it? I was going to say, it's so easy to come up with the criticism, oh, yeah, big oil. Peter Williams, big oil. You know, he's funded by big oil.
End of argument.
Yeah.
Yeah,
don't listen to the facts. Yeah,
but you listen to Willie Soon, you listen to William Happer, listen to Richard Linson, and listen to Bjorn Lomborg, who actually, I think, believes in man-made climate change, but he says no matter what the world does, it's going to make no difference whatsoever. We can't stop it because we can spend trillions of dollars and we will not stop the warming of the planet. But the warming is not going to be that particularly tragic anyway, because people will not die of climate change, as we keep on being told that they will.
And that tragedy of what you're saying in the news media of speaking out of turn and compromise, that is magnified 100-fold in our universities and polytechnics.
Mm.
So if you're an academic, if you don't toe the party line, you will not get it. You will not get a job. You'll not get advanced. You'll not be able to shift. You will not get your papers published.
Where are principles, though? Where have principles?
Well, you see, this is part of the philosophical...
Surely you'd say, screw you. You're not going to do that to me.
This is part of the philosophical shift, you know, and the philosophical shift of, oh, well, you know, that's just your view. This is this identity politics. That's your view. You're saying, hang on, no, I'm trying to understand.
Well, it's like Pete. I mean, he could. You got out. You just weren't prepared to take it.
Yeah, no, well, they
where are these people?
Well, that's why the people that Peter quoted who climate change is quite... affects me quite deeply because I at 15 became a rabid environmentalist, and like you
that's
do,
that's an interview over.
You do when you're young and idealistic. You know, when you're young and idealistic, you are looking for a cause, and I think that is abused.
Mm.
and it is abused by people who are wanting to advance themselves or advance their political discourse or their narrative. And I naively believed at 15 that they were telling me the truth and that I needed to be an activist. That's why I'm so hot on it. And I dedicated 10 years of my life. And looking back on it, it was like a cult. So I am hot on it. And it's this idea of a narrative. It's an idea that there's not a real world out there. There's an idea that these people have to be shut down because they're wrong. And the climate change scientists that Peter refers to, they're either all retired and emeritus professors right. who can't lose their tenure, or they are so distinguished that they can't be touched. Now,
there's only a few of those.
Yes, and there's no young ones, right? And that's why ultimately they will win, because they have killed off the opposition. It's the same with almost. Can you imagine being a New Zealand academic and says, "Hang on, this treaty doesn't mean partnership." You might be a law professor, you might be a law student saying, goodbye. Do you think that you could get a job in New Zealand trying to make that point, even though it is manifestly true? Or can you imagine getting a job if you just put your hand up and said, look, colonialism, yeah, you know, on balance, I think it was quite good for Maori.
Yeah, as Paul Goldsmith found out to his cost politically yes. when he said what I thought was a perfectly reasonable thing. What about another younger guy in the medical profession by the name of Simon Thornley?
Absolutely.
Remember Simon Thornley?
I do.
COVID Plan B?
Yes.
Epidemiologist, highly qualified, medically trained, postgrad in epidemiology.
More qualified than most people that were commenting in the New Zealand media as experts.
That's right. So he makes some comments saying, lockdowns are basically a waste of time.
Mm-hmm.
Let's not go that way. So he came up with the COVID Plan B. What has happened to Simon Thornley now?
Disappeared.
And apparently has been shut down so badly. I know of a documentary circulating about that time in our lives. The documentary is towards the end of its production and is not far away from being released. Thornley was interviewed for the program, after he spoke to his lawyer advised him that that interview should not be shown. Wow. So, I mean, that's how much people like Thornley, who should contribute to academic discussion on this hugely important topic, they should be allowed to have their say and have an opinion. He's been shut out of it, gone.
There's that, but maybe someone could help me out here. Why does it go to the level of wanting to destroy the person?
Mm.
I mean,
well, I think it's like this.
Why is this such exactly a shock reaction? Shock troops.
I know exactly what it is. It's like they're holding a dam, right?
Right.
And you get one leak, right? And the dam will fall. The narrative will fall.
So they know that that could happen. So it's willful.
Willful. Also, it's a signal. See what we did to that guy?
Mm.
That's you.
You don't want to be like him?
Nope. And it becomes a story. And if you look at this is a long history in pharmaceutical industry and the medical industry in America going right back. We're very eminent. You know, there's a debate about AIDS and what was the best treatment. And a very famous, epidemiologist, virologist, Peter Duisberg, I hope I've got his name right. And I remember him questioning the narrative for the story of AIDS, and he was utterly destroyed, utterly mm-hmm. and completely destroyed by Fauci. He got no funding, no students, nothing, and he was finished. And again, that sent a message to anyone that would question the wisdom of the central government's agency's views and, of course, the largesse of money. I was at university, you know, getting grants in the late 80s, early 90s. And I mean, if you wanted to get a grant from the government, you had to somehow wrap up climate change in it.
No matter.
Even back then.
Yes.
No matter what you're doing.
And even back then, it started the treaty. said, so I'm studying this snail, and it'll be the ecology of the snail, and we'll find out this and that, and it'll be very important to our better understanding of climate change in New Zealand. And you needed that word in there. Or this would be very important to our better understanding of the treaty and its implications for resource management in New Zealand.
Did you write those?
I did.
You took the money, Rodney? That's money.
Yeah. Well, I was naive.
Naive.
I was extremely naive because back then too, I was starting to get awake to the environmental movement. And realizing that it had nothing to do with the issue at hand.
Did you have a Patrick Moore moment? Did you? You know Patrick Moore, one of the founders of Greenpeace?
Yes.
He pretty much had the same sort of road to Damascus experience as you appear to have.
Yes,
had.
And it was absolutely gut-wrenching. Because I remember going to my professors and I had this idea that maybe here we could use private property and it would give a better outcome, and it was just an anathema. And I sat with my senior colleagues, and I remember this to this day, them grabbing hold of the treaty issues, which was completely new, like what's the treaty got to do with water management, and saying they could use that to stop the government's plans for state-owned enterprises. And so it was this willful weaponization by professors to use the treaty as an argument, and Maori, they were to be used to win a political argument. And I thought we were there trying to figure out what was best for New Zealand.
So what do you think are some genuine solutions? Because we visited the Netherlands recently, me and Jacob, and what's happening in the Netherlands is the government are forcing farmers to sell their land. Like I call it stealing, because I think it is stealing. They don't want to move off their land. They've been there their whole lives. The government's forcing them off their land because of climate change. So then they're going to build most of that out in houses, which is not better for that land, obviously. And then they're importing. The Netherlands are the third largest exporter of goods from Brazil. Brazil's cutting down their rainforest. So they're going to export on a higher level from Brazil, who are cutting down the rainforest, and get rid of their amazing farmland, all in the name of climate change. So the climate agenda that they're trying to implement is ridiculous. But what are some other solutions that would be genuinely beneficial?
Well, I spent, 30 years, not full time, but a lot of time, studying climate change and having all the arguments. And I realised that's a fool's errand, because they're not interested in the argument. They're not actually interested in climate change. And when I say that, I'm meaning the people that are pushing these agendas. And it is an agenda.
What are they interested in?
Power, tyrannical power. These are people that believe that they are smart and clever, and they're all around us. You know, your bespeckled university professor, he can think that he's nice, benign guy writing away here, just doing his papers, but he believes his views should be running New Zealand because he's an intellectual. It's that Plato thing. It's that philosopher king. And so there are amongst us people that want to rule over you, and they're politicians and they're bureaucrats, and they go into these fields. It's a genetic thing, I think, whereas I just want to try and be a good person and contribute to the world. I know plenty of people who think that the way to contribute to the world is to boss other people around. Mm-hmm. And they have that totalitarian impulse. And so every time they see two ways of moving, they'll always tend towards the totalitarian way rather than the one letting the people choose. And so my view now, after having wasted my career, is to realise what's going on. The climate change agenda is to destroy farming. And what they want is corporate and state farming. And corporate farming now means state farming, because you might have a corporation in name, but it'll be so beholden to the state that it's really run by the state. And there's nothing more inimical to a government wanting to direct how we behave than a farmer and a farmer's family.
Because they're too
independent.
Free thinking or
independent. They're independent and they know what to do.
So you take them out.
Take them
and
out.
And then you can rule the game.
Yes. Do you take out, just let me, sorry, Shijian, I didn't mean to interrupt. Take out families.
Right.
Take out farming families. take out men. And
who does that leave?
It leaves a scared and atomized population who are reliant on government. And it's amazing. And, I mean, just that fear. And, you see, let's put aside whether the COVID response was right or wrong. I've never seen a government, and it happened all around the world, where you actually ruled by fear.
Mm. Well, Matt Hancock has admitted as much in his WhatsApp message. He used the very word, F-E-A-R.
Yeah.
Now, Seymour, as the leader of the ACT Party, asked Hipkins that question in the Parliament just last week. At question time, Hipkins said, "I didn't see any fear." Now,
they were stoking it, and so was David Seymour.
He was the man, wasn't he?
But Seymour asked the question, so do we take our parliamentarians at their word with what they say in the House at question time? And I looked at that question, I looked at the answer, and I raised an eyebrow with the deepest of cynicism, and I think I have every cause to. Really?
I do want to ask a further question, though, on the climate change thing, right? Because you've got two separate concepts here. You've got climate change as environmentalism, and then you've got real environmentalism, as in what can actually make a real impact to our environment that we're living in right now, such as cleaning up the seas, that type of thing, like real actionable change. And I feel like a lot of environmentalists have gone towards climate change because it's such an easy topic to sit there and talk about while you're having a latte. You know, you don't actually have to be out there doing anything.
That's of course, they're just sort of either in on it or a useful idiot.
What kind of latte, though?
To answer your question about what we do, I think, and including the environment, is that the first thing we do is we look to ourselves. It's that Jordan Peterson line of cleaning up your bedroom. You know, the best thing you can get a young person to do to help with the environment is to tidy up the garage, tidy up their room and start on their garden, then they can start on the street. So it's actually looking to yourself, it's looking to your family and building up a good family and your friends with good values and a healthy outlook and respect. And if you respect yourself, you'll look after the environment and you'll only be looking after your little bit. You know, but everyone looks after their little bit, it adds up. And then it's about building community, because I don't think we can look to the top to rescue us. I think we have to, and this is why I'm so excited about RCR, because I think we have to look deep within ourselves. We have to be better people. We have to learn to look after ourselves better. We have to learn to look after each other better. And out of that will become a confidence. And we can overcome the fear because, you know, the climate change is a fear thing. And you think of the darkest days of World War II, the Winston Churchill and the leaders of the free countries, they didn't instill fear. They instilled hope.
Hope, exactly.
And we will overcome. But nowadays, our governments, in a time of peace, instill fear. That's what we've got to overcome.
I want to get on to politics because this is election year. We're starting up now. Of course, we're going to be interested in election year. And I don't know about folks you talk with, but in my limited group, a lot more limited than it used to be.
Yeah, I've got two.
We struggle to even think of someone to vote for. I've never been in that situation before. I always used to buy into, well, you know, you can't complain if you don't vote. It's your duty to vote.
Yeah, I know. But the question...
What do you do when you don't have an option?
The question you're asking at the moment is, when you look back on our recent political leaders, and I'll go back in my lifetime to when I was first aware of a prime minister, that was Keith Holyoake in the early 1960s, I'm thinking, who was the last prime minister that I really liked and respected? In fact, of all the prime ministers that there have been in my lifetime, who have I liked and respected and thought was a good leader of people? Mm. Holyoake, because, well, he was the first one and he was always, you know, solid and New Zealand was doing pretty well economically. Kirk, because it was time for a change, I thought, yes, that is... That makes sense. It's the world is changing. I was realizing that because I was 18 when he was elected. Muldoon, I could never respect Muldoon because he was just a bully. Longy really inspired me because I just thought Longy was, he was a fantastic individual. He was larger than life. In fact, he was larger than most of us, wasn't he? Until he had himself shrunk. And he had this complete re-grooming.
And he was funny.
He was very funny.
He's the funniest thing on TV.
Yeah. And I don't know whether or not he was a great prime minister, but he was... He was a dominant personality in New Zealand. And then we just, Jim was a bit blah, really, wasn't he? Jenny Shipley, the less said, the better. Helen Clark, I think in the end, grudgingly, I look back and think, yes, she was a strong leader. She knew what she stood for. And she would put down a lot of the nonsense that's going on in this country today, I think. But key on reflection has been a massive disappointment. Mm. Massive disappointment. And then, well, since 2017, frankly, the less said the better. So who have been the prime ministers, the people that I've respected in my lifetime? Probably two. Probably Holyoke and Longy and Kirk, because it was all different at the time.
So what do we do?
What do we do now?
Well, I know who I'm voting for. Yeah. Well, because it's the only person I can trust, and that's my dad. Well, so that's an easy vote on my behalf.
Were you surprised at how he did in that poll?
Yes and no. I was surprised they published him in the poll. I'm not surprised
How did his name get on the ballot?
They've just asked people who do you think is a preferred PM.
So that's an organic response.
An organic amount of 3.9% said Leighton Baker.
So 1,000 people... of 1,000 people, 39 people said Leighton Baker.
Hmm.
They rang his church.
I don't think so. His original one was pretty mandate friendly.
How close does that get you then to a 5%?
Very close.
Potentially to
because
a 5%
all you got to do, and I mean, Leighton would have my vote. I don't care, Labour, National, to me, they're going to mess around at the edges and not deal.
Are they all on the same side?
They're on the same side. They're on the same side through our darkest days of my lifetime when they locked us all down. They're all on the same side. One thing to agree, but to go in lockstep over everything, that was to me...
You've got the background. You know how it works in the back rooms. Can you explain that? Is that an unprecedented thing?
Totally unprecedented. You can imagine people agreeing in a sort of like a wartime emergency or agreeing to a framework, right? And I could imagine that when there's obviously I've never experienced anything like that as a politician, so it's unknown territory to me. But the idea that an opposition leader or opposition MPs wouldn't come down to meet people angry with the government to me is just unbelievable, because you're looking for, like, every vote that you can get. And you don't have to agree. I've met with Maori protest. I've met with every protester that ever turned up to Parliament. No, not because I agree.
It's your duty, isn't it?
I agree. Yeah, absolutely, it's your duty. You're a House of Representatives. You're in a very, very privileged position. These people don't have your access, and they've come to Parliament to express a view, and you're duty-bound to go and listen to it. And it wouldn't matter if it was one, I'd go down and talk to them. Because we're in New Zealand. It's the size of a little city anywhere in the world. But the thing I like about Shane, I've said I'm a single-issue voter this election, first time in my life. I'm going to vote for the party that promises a parliamentary inquiry into the vaccine injury. And the party that does that, they got my vote. But Leighton's got my vote because he turned up to the protest and was a leader there, and he stood firm. And so I feel that there is a man of principle.
And that was one of the things that was used to kind of give them an out, not to confront. You'd have no leader. You know, you're all disparate sort of wackos who can't sort out who the boss is. And they used that as a pretext for not communicating. I mean, you were there. I know there were a few politicians sort of walking up and down the lanes, let's say, kind of keeping a low profile. Did you get to talk to any of them during that time?
No. Not one of them actually came to properly engage. And I mean, Winnie runs in, gets a photo op, runs away. You know,
but wasn't Seymour himself around the protest?
I know. From what I know about what happened with Seymour,
he went across the road, didn't he, to the backbencher?
From what I know, he was sitting in a cafe somewhere, or he might have been sitting in the backbencher, hiding away in a corner, and protesters found him and confronted him. And then he said he met with protesters. But was that a meeting, or was it a confrontation?
And the other thing is, maybe you guys haven't heard this before. Yeah. I compared an event for the Free Speech Union in Dunedin last year, and Michael Woodhouse was on the panel. Michael Woodhouse maintains that he was out and about talking to the protesters. Now, no public record of that.
No, well, he definitely didn't get on a mic and say anything. They definitely didn't come down the steps and say anything.
It's very interesting what you say about no leaders, because that's very true. And at the protest, and that was, to my mind, unprecedented of a protest to Parliament. Mm. Because you normally expect, you know, the farmers to organise, and they have a person that's organised it, and they have a delegation, and they go off and they can go and see the minister's office. This thing was spontaneous. Mm. It was from the ground up. It was literally people seeing the convoy and saying, I'm off to Wellington, and joining in. And it was that spontaneity that made it. It was like our Woodstock moment, you know. It was just amazing. And the fact no one would presume to speak on behalf of the people that were there, because every person there had their own story. And, again, that was what was so powerful about it. And I was there. I'd never presumed to speak on behalf of anyone there, because it wasn't organised.
But that doesn't stop someone standing up and saying, OK, this is incredible. I see you all here. I understand the issues. I hear you. Mm. I'm here.
A politician could do that.
I can't hear anything more than that.
It would have been enough.
I reckon they would have gone home, to be honest. If Jacinda had come down those steps, if she had come down those steps and she had said, look, I hear what you're saying. I understand what I've put you through over the last few months or over the last year has been traumatic. I understand that there are people that have personal stories. But what you have to understand is I'm trying to do this for the greater good of our country. I'm trying to do this for this reason, this reason, this reason. Please understand that as soon as I possibly can, I will drop the mandates because I understand. Yeah. If she had done that, I think most of them would have gone home, to be honest.
So that's about a minute?
Yeah, 1 minute, one minute.
If Chris Luxon had come down and spoken to that group, he'd be on his way to being Prime Minister right now.
Absolutely.
So he would be a different...
So they don't know how to call it even.
I don't think they...
Can you run a country when you don't even understand that?
I don't think they began to understand. I didn't understand what was going on. And I watched that protest through Chantal, and I was there, and then I got the opportunity to go just for a day. And it was the most amazing experience of my life, outside of, you know, personal family things, that I have ever experienced by an order of magnitude. And I felt it the moment I walked in.
Electric.
It was warm, it was engaging, and it made me realise what New Zealand had lost. Yeah. Because there were people who were smiling, there were people who were happy, there were people that were hugging. I'm not a hugger, and I ended up loving getting hugs because we had become so fearful of each other. You know, you'd walk, you'd go and do your shopping in the supermarket all masked up and everyone's scared and they'd all be like this around you. And suddenly you were with people and there was this warmth. And it just felt and clever people who could sing and dance and build toilets and construct stuff. And you saw that. I've never seen anything like that. And, of course, the other thing about the protests there is there were people there that had lost everything.
There's no sympathy. Well, there is. But amongst a lot of people, there's no sympathy for that.
No. And people who had lost their health through the vaccines. And so you were there and you realised these people had... You know, normally you get a protest and it rains, everyone rushes home. Right? Because it's not serious, really.
It's raining.
You get Greenpeace and it rains, they're gone. These protests... It poured. They had sprinklers on them. They had abuse hurled at them. They were there. And then the people that were there were tradespeople. They were farmers. They were business people.
They kicked in.
They could do stuff. They could feed themselves. They could house themselves. They could make sanitary arrangements. It was amazing. These are people never protested in their life before.
How could you turn your back on people like that? I still can't get to the bottom of that.
No, if you disagree with everything they said or stood for.
They must have known in their hearts that this was wrong.
I don't know, though. I've spoken to a few people, and the whole rhetoric of January the 6th and insurrection, you know, where those dangerous people that were just holding flags. No, I know, but, you know, those dangerous people just holding flags, taking photos for a building, whatever. So they have tried to – they genuinely thought that the protesters were going to try and take the building at some stage. And so that was the rhetoric that was going all throughout Parliament. So people genuinely were scared because they had no idea
what was actually
happening. Exactly. And they were told that they were not allowed to go down by their party. So none of them came down. But I remember after that first day of violence, you know, when the people were sitting down, backs to the police, just being put in headlocks, dragged out, you know, old ladies had their collarbones broken and all of that. My mum and dad and even my fiancé Jake, they weren't up there at that stage. I wasn't even going to go to Wellington because I thought it would just end in Picton. I didn't know what was happening. I got the ferry across one day and then, you know, ended up staying. But I was definitely there.
We all know that.
That was when the ferry used to work.
Oh, back in the good old days. Lovely sunny day too. But I remember we got to the end of that day and you guys would have known. I mean, that was traumatic for, I think, thousands of us that kind of experienced it, that saw it the whole lot. And I rung mum and dad and I said, because I felt like A, there was a lack of leadership, but B, there were a lack of any authority figures. So, and by that I mean people that, someone that everyone recognised, someone that spoke a lot of sense, because if they recognised them, there were some people that just weren't saying much of anything, you know, or taking people down all these tracks that were really unhelpful. So I remember ringing dad and just saying, like, they need you here. Like, you need to come, like, I need you here, but they need you here more. Hmm. People just needed someone level that could, you know, try and, like, just keep people calm and then talk to, like, the police and try and figure out, like, what they could actually do to help everybody, because it was an eclectic bunch of brilliant human beings.
The two things too. I was always worried that they couldn't demonstrate that the vaccine was safe, but I didn't believe that people would be injured by it. I just couldn't get that into my head. And when I went to the protest, it was my great privilege and great sadness to meet people who were so badly injured by that vaccine, acknowledged by their doctors and the medical profession as badly injured. This isn't stuff in their heads. And to see that level of suffering, I mean, for me, the lockdowns were an inconvenience and a frustration and an economic disaster. But to see New Zealanders who had done what they were told by people they trusted and put their faith in the so-called science and the medical fraternity, and to see them, their bodies destroyed and their lives destroyed, and then to struggle to Parliament and to have no one. This wasn't a protest about what's right and what's wrong, what the government should do or shouldn't do. This was a protest about people that had done exactly what they had been told to do. They had been told, do this, or you'll lose your job. And they have suffered catastrophic, lifelong injury. And they come to Parliament, and not one person comes to visit them. Now, here's the scary thing. The government admits that, yes, there are people injured by the vaccine, but... and yes, there are people who died because of the vaccine. All we're arguing about is, say, the numbers, and I don't know the true number. So they admit that. Well, these injured people and the families and loved ones of these people who died were there that day. the people that made that decision to inflict that on them for the good of society in their eyes wouldn't even meet them. That is just, that's not, or I could go down there and get some votes, or I better go down and listen to these point of view. This is something very deeply, fundamentally inhuman.
I went back to another protest. I think it was maybe a month afterwards, after Wellington, they had a protest for the jab injured specifically. And they presented a big petition to one of the national guys, can't remember his name, presented a petition to one of the national guys. You had people there in wheelchairs, people that were severely debilitated.
That'll be your Michael Woodhouse moment.
Yeah. Yeah, and what's happened from it?
I haven't heard anything.
I've heard absolutely nothing.
We're heading probably towards the end of this chat now. Mm. So now we've kicked off RCR, Reality Check Radio. We're all going to be doing stuff here, and there'll be others as well. So let's just go around the table. Rodney, you're on the other side, 180 degree. we get a lot of 180 degree these days, don't we? Mainly projection. But, okay, so I think you've mentioned that there's been a lost art of conversation and debate. So where are you going to be coming from in what you talk about, the people you talk to?
No, I think it's – I hope to interact with the audience, and I'd love to be audience-driven. That is to say, what the audience is interested in hearing, what they're interested in discussing, who they're interested in having on the show. So to me, I would regard myself in that very privileged position of speaking on behalf of that audience and doing what that audience can't do, which is get interesting people and ask them questions, and to set up a sort of interesting two-way conversation. And it's not about me being right or me knowing all the answers, but to me, a conversation we had earlier about putting the questions that we all have and to try and learn and to grow and to try and understand one another. You know, like, what's wrong with that? Why can't we try and understand people who disagree with us? Because they might be right. And we probably will find when we get talking to someone that we both learn a bit. You know what I mean? That's what I see doing. But I think that we have to be very respectful of our audience and do what they want to hear, because that's the great gap in New Zealand, where over and over our government and our media and our companies and our banks and our airline are all telling us what we've got to think, how we've got to feel, how we have to. I'm sick of that. I am so sick of getting on the airplane to fly to Christchurch and being told by Air New Zealand what to think and how to feel about things.
I just want a seat. Okay.
Is it their new tagline? No. In New Zealand, I just want a seat.
That's my new tagline.
And I know already how to put a seatbelt on.
Yeah, there you go. Oh, well, you can work that one out. Chantel.
Oh, yes. Sorry. Delayed reaction. Is it going to be my show just very slow?
No. Well, same question, really. Same question. I mean, you've had experiences that, well, I haven't had. You've been close up to a lot of stuff. Albeit recently, and we're not seeking to be a one-issue kind of station. We're aware of that. But where will you be going? Who will you be talking to?
I think I really want to.
What do you want to find out? What do you want to help people?
I think I want to focus on what the media isn't talking about. And that's such a range of topics. And, I mean, this is why we went to Ukraine. This is why we went to the Netherlands and met with the Netherlands farmers. It's why we've gone and spoken to different groups, like in the UK. And we went as many places as we could in as short a time frame as possible. And, yeah, I just really want to understand, because I know firsthand, and I think the one thing I learned at Parliament was that what the media say versus what you're told are two completely different things.
And so, the Hawke's Bay.
Yeah, and was up in Napier for 3 weeks with the same thing.
That'll
right?
be a story, won't it?
Yeah, it's been fascinating. And so we've got. I think what I've learned this whole time is what aren't the media saying, or at least what aren't our media saying, because there's a lot of international stories that don't get covered here, and I kind of want to drill into the why and who's involved and what does it mean for our country.
Cool, Pete.
Well, I'm working on air during the daytime, and mostly in the afternoons, and it's going to be pretty cruisy because I intend to play quite a lot of music.
Great music.
Yeah. Who's it going to be programmed by, Paul? You. And me, I'll offer a few
suggestions every now and then.
but in between quite a few of those songs, I'm prone to have a bit of a rant about stuff.
Oh, we love your rants. Some of your rants have been epic.
Yeah, so I'm just going to offer a few thoughts on a few matters. And if people want to respond to those rants, I will be inviting them to get in touch with me. There may be people who vehemently disagree with me. If they do, I'm more than happy to have a conversation with them as well, because there are so many things that need to be talked about openly. But, like, for instance, as we talk today, what is the biggest story in Britain? What is the biggest story in Britain as we speak right now? It's not Matt Hancock. Matt Hancock is last week's news. The biggest story is Gary Lineker.
Yes.
Now, Gary Lineker is a mere TV sports presenter. Okay, once upon a time he was a really, really good player, but he's a TV sports presenter. Having been a TV sports presenter at times in my life, let me say, it's not a particularly important job, okay? It's not important. But Gary Lineker has decided that he is important, so therefore he's offering opinion on British government policy, which is completely and utterly outside the wheelhouse, I'm sure, of his £1.3 million a year contract. It shows one thing in Britain, and that's the power of football. Football seems to be way more important than any political party, and the football party is probably the most important party in Britain.
But I read in the Daily Mail today
that
it went from all the commentators walked out.
Yeah, and the audience went from 2 million to 2.5 million. So Match of the Day is usually a one-hour program, which apparently has got, as a columnist in the Telegraph or whatever wrote, every now and then a bit of football is shown in between all the people talking about it. So they drop all the punditry, drop the front man, and just have 20 minutes of football action with no commentary, no commentary at all, because the fans identify the players and the teams, and it's written up on the screen anyway, and the audience is up by 500,000.
That's amazing.
Now, Paul.
Yes.
So I'll be ranting about that sort of stuff.
It's probably AI commentators in the future.
And I always feel with Peter that there's a man who's calmly and soberly read the news and read
the sports. That was a past life.
All the time. There's this, and it's, we've captured it, you know, that 50 years of experience. But Paul, you're the main man here.
Yes and no.
We look to you. What do you want to be doing on the show?
Good question. I'm curious. I've always been really curious, and I'm always interested to find things out. And I don't mind if I don't like the answer. I just want to find things out. Mm. So, and I think many people are curious, and I think we've lost a lot of curiosity. Mm. I don't think we've actually lost it. We've been scared to be curious because some questions are difficult. And if you're a curious person, you'll ask them regardless. So I obviously going to stay across what's happening, and I'm going to keep in touch with you guys as well and all our contributors, and I'm going to read the audience feedback, and we know already that there's going to be a beep load of it, right? Mm. And I will follow my own curiosity, but also the curiosity of others. And I don't know what it will be. I don't know. I mean, there are the main issues, but there are also other things. I mean, I'm a great aviation fan, so I'll want to tell people. People are always interested in airlines. They fly. Mm. What's the state of the art? There'll be a bit of that. I love science, physics. Mm. I can't get enough of it. Virtual reality, you know, those sorts of things. So I reckon it'll go everywhere, but I'll make a commitment to this. It'll be bloody interesting.
Yes. Tell me this, for the audience. How will the audience interact with the hosts and get in touch with us?
In the early days, it's a work in progress. We can
make it challenging.
Yeah.
Signal pigeons.
Yes, that's right.
Will there be an email address, Paul?
How long does it take for the pigeon to fly from here? There is an email address, and I need to confirm that before we put that out, and that will be in all the publicity and everything, but there will be an email address, and that will be the first point of contact. And I've lived through this scenario before on another setup, so that's how we started. There'll be a text service very quickly, so for when we do stuff in real time, and there will be a mix of pre-recorded and real time, as there is with every broadcasting operation. You know, some people aren't available in real time to talk to, so we're going to have to pre-record it. And in the early days of rolling out RCR, because of the way we've put it together, we need to road test the supply chain of content. Okay. And we need to make sure it's bulletproof before we really go out and beat our chests.
And
so think of it as a beta
got it.
Type of operation.
Ultimately,
first.
Would people be able to ring?
Yes, they will.
Great.
We'll have, once we're majority live, which won't take long. We're not talking about long here, folks. Once we're majority live.
Given it's Monday.
Well, we all came to that decision, didn't we? It was all democratic and everything. No one stood over anybody. There will be phone calls, and we will do talkback shows, and we will have live call-ins. We'll have live texts. Texts by far are the most popular these days. Mm. There's no question. Mm. And they can fill up a lot of time, and some of them are genius. So yes. That'll be there.
Yeah.
And, of course, with the technology that's out there, we can, you know, cross to the other side of the world as if and sound like we're both in the same studio. So what we can do going forward is just incredible. And then, of course, we get into out of the audio-only space, and we move into where Chantel is now into – and it's an obvious thing, into the television. It's not quite television, but the video space as well. Mm. And, you know, what you'll find is that the content that is produced, which is the gold, or hopefully will be the gold, will go out in that medium as well, probably as a social media, obviously distributed content items. And the potential of that is just massive.
Mm.
It really is. It can dwarf the real-time listening experience in terms of numbers so much. And then we'll be you'll be starting to see people.
Wow.
It'll start to be TV. And I mean, we call it radio. It will sound like radio, and I think it's fair enough to say now with internet radio, that is radio.
Mm.
You know, people don't know, well, that sounds like it's coming through a terrestrial transmitter, Martha.
Yes.
You know, there is no, and with apps and streaming and Bluetooth and cars, it's easier to push that app button or that internet.
CarPlay button.
Yeah, than, you know, tuning the radio. It's the same thing, and I think people are there already. We've seen that already. So we're going to start off with some humility, and we're going to do what we can do. We've got some great talent, and we've got very receptive, pool of guests and potential guests out there. They want to talk.
Yeah, well, your excitement is contagious.
Well, thank you.
And your enthusiasm carries us all along.
Well, I know we can do it, you see, because I've been there before and I know we can do it.
We can do it. And tell me this, do you think we'll have our critics?
Oh, yeah.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
I'm anticipating none.
Hey, bring it on.
Bring it on. So what might we be criticised by?
Well, the criticism I've seen so far, and I haven't been, too busy looking because I kind of know what the negative stuff's going to say. But you got to do better than that, folks. Honestly, if you really want to bowl us over with your criticism, you need to go back to the drawing board. Some of it is just so facile and stupid.
But they're also criticising the audience, aren't they?
Well, they are. They're presupposing it's a particular audience.
Yeah.
And I don't think you can do that.
No.
And we're not doing that.
Don't criticise your customer.
I mean, no, never. Never turn them away. Never tell them to beep off as soon as they come into your shop.
I hope we get heaps.
That's not going to work.
I hope we get heaps because that'll generate an interest.
If we do what is wanted, we will do well.
Yes.
But we'll find out, won't we?
Mm-hmm. Well, let's take this baby for a ride.
Yeah. Well,
sorry.
You mean like a bicycle?
Yeah.
Well, let's do that. So I think this has been a great chat. I really do. I we've ranged over so many things, and I've got a lot to think about it from what you guys have been saying. And I think we're calibrating it correctly for what we want to do. But we will see, and we're open to anything. But I think this has been a great chat, so I want to thank you guys.
Well, thank you, Paul.
Thank you.
Well, wasn't that refreshing? Wasn't that absolutely just fantastic to hear Reality Check Radio with Paul Brennan, Peter Williams, Chantal Baker. Well, wasn't that fabulous? I enjoyed listening to those four. Chantal Baker, Peter Williams, Rodney Hyde, and Paul Brennan. That was just marvellous. And wasn't it refreshing to hear them speaking freely about all the subjects that have been taboo over the last three years? And now we know we can actually go and hear what's really going on in New Zealand. And I think they're going to be having talkback. They'll certainly be having people emailing in, as Paul was intimating. It sounds like Paul was really putting in a lot of hard work. Paul is a very talented broadcaster from many years ago. My sister Leanne actually worked with Paul. I think it was at 2XX or 1XX. Yeah, I think, I'm not sure, one of those X's. And he was her program director, so he certainly knows all about radio. So I'm really looking forward to hearing what's going to happen with Reality Check Radio, RCR. So exciting, and I wish them all the best, and I hope you do too. Make sure you tune in. Just Google search Reality. Actually, it'll be in, I'll put it in my description, the link to the live stream. I hope you really enjoy it. I know I will. Tell all your friends, share it with everybody. So until next time, this is Grant Edwards for Liberty NZ and Counterspin Media. Until next time, this is Grant Edwards for Liberty NZ and Counterspin Media.